The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 289. It's for Wednesday, the 7th of September, 2011. My name is Jules Cisek here in California, and I'm with Martin Darlington over in Wales, where it's
0605.
Right. Morning.
Yes, it is very, it's very morning here. It's very dark. Sun's not up yet. Not that we've got to see it in the last few days. Right. We're getting the tail end of Hurricane Irene now.
Are you getting that? Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's just strong winds and lots of rain. Right. But yeah, no, they the ones that come up your eastern seaboard seem to bounce off the New England area, shoot across the Atlantic and pee all over us.
Well, we apologize.
Absolutely. I held you personally responsible.
Yes, yes. So we had an amazing weekend of racing, very little sleep.
Yes.
Because there was a lot going on, both the World Superbikes and MotoGP had. But before we get into all that, we should go through some listener feedback, as we've been getting some really fantastic feedback from everybody in the last few months, and it just keeps coming. So we love it. We're going to keep answering this stuff because it usually starts off some really nice conversations, and keep it coming.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to start with an email. Mark Hale sent a very quick email with a link in it to findthethrottle.net, where there's a very fascinating article that was written about the Rossi Ducati situation, and it takes a very different kind of approach, which is to compare the like average results of Casey Stoner on the Ducati versus Valentino Rossi on the Ducati, and comes to the conclusion that in the beginning of the article, it comes to the conclusion that Rossi's consistency stays the same, but it's now lower, whereas Casey Stoner's consistency was always, you know, up and down. You know, he's winning races, he's falling off the bike, and then from that extrapolates a very interesting theory. I mean, a lot of it's not a theory, it's a lot of it's fact. Casey Stoner is a throttle man, and Valentino Rossi is a brake man. And, you know, what does the Ducati lack? It lacks front end feel. So a brake man is going to be hurt a lot more by that than a throttle man. You know, but Stoner still has to stop sometimes, you know. So maybe that's where his unusual amount of crashes during races that he had when he was in a duck came from. But I really like the kind of no holds barred style of the article, and I think it's a fantastic read, even if you don't necessarily agree with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the conclusion was brutally honest, but probably quite right, that the Ducati will work for Valentino once Ducati build him a Yamaha or a Honda.
Right.
And Joey Burgess apparently let slip this week that they're testing an aluminium frame, but he's also pointed out pretty much what was being said in the article that Mark sent to us, that look, we tweak it. The engineers send us the bike, and then we have a certain amount of leeway where we can adjust it. But if we run out of adjustments, they have to send us a different bike, but we can't do that. We can only, you know, make us a very finite amount of adjustment to what we've got, what we're working with. The baseline is where the problem is, and that needs to move.
Right.
Because it's getting it better, isn't it?
I think that the legend of Burgess and Valentino Rossi as a team being able to solve anything is gotten a little out of control, because I think, you know, we know that. We know that, you know, they adjust the bike, they don't develop the bike, but we forget that because, and this is not necessarily the smartest thing to do, but I actually made the mistake of of reading the comments in one MCN story recently. I don't even remember what it was. I think it was Stoner slagging off or something about something. But my God, the comments, the comment section on MCN, wow. It's just, it's so polarized. It's like, there's people who either absolutely can't stand Rossi and they're loving the seasons watching him suffer, kind of, and then the fanboys, and nobody's actually, I don't know, nobody's actually thinking it through, because it really is just that, you know, there's no team involved, there's no factory involved, there's no history, there's no, you know, changes in rules, there's no, I mean, it's hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, there are objective people in the middle. I like to think we are. But I've noticed even the Rossi fans are splitting now into those who are absolute blind faith he'll be world champion next year because he'll make them sort the bike out, to those that are saying, well, that's it, greatest of all time, it's finished, never win another race, should retire, he's going to walk away.
Right.
I don't think he's going to do either. I think he'll continue, and I think he'll do better next year, but I can't see him.
He's not going away. You know, he's got, unless he gets hurt, he's going to be in MotoGP for a few years. And, you know, I mean, he's really, I think he's, the one thing that I really do not like seeing is when people say that he's disillusioned or, you know, he's not trying. That's bullshit. You know, I mean, you just watch him and he's really still enjoying it. You know, I mean, sure, he'd love to be winning races, but he's not just putting on the face.
One of the commentators, I can't remember who it was, said that it's incredible how well he's coped. You know, he still manages to smile at the camera. He's still, you know, we've probably seen him a lot more thoughtful this year than we have before. But, I mean, you consider what he's been used to and what he's having to deal with, I think it's a huge kudos to him for the way he's managed to just keep on a level, you know, a level mental approach to it.
It's not even saying, oh, because he's stuck on it with a bad bike, because maybe he and the bike will never meet, you know, where they need to meet.
Yeah.
But,
no, exactly.
But despite that, I think he's still, it's not putting on a brave face. I think he's just really making the best of it, you know?
And as we mentioned last week, someone said, you know, this is now equaled already his worst ever season for crashes, 6.
Right.
I thought, that's incredible. In all practices, and you know, everything put together, I suspect that Randy, the Randy DiPugno season we mentioned, probably had more crashes in it than Rossi's had in his entire career.
Oh yeah, sure.
Including riding his little pedal scooter around his garden when he was 3. You know, I mean, it's just, and that's this. It's incredibly impressive, and from that point of view. But of course, it's not getting him any closer to Aggo's record or. Or, you know, another title. I don't think he'll win another title. I think he's got no chance of getting anywhere near Aggo's or getting much closer to Aggo's record.
No.
Because I think there's too many up-and-comers, but...
I think there's still a chance that he can win a title. There's no way he's going to ever match the wins.
No.
For Aggo. There's no way.
17 to equal and 18 to beat him.
Yeah.
That's a whole season of wins.
Exactly.
We also heard from Mike Leighton, who was this week's outraged listener, but not to us, I'm happy to say. He was listening to the podcast on the way to work this morning, and the guy in the IMS call, this was from episode 2 weeks ago, who was asking about the risks of racing, touched a nerve with me. I was at a Wira event in Pocono in the early 90s. Is that Pocono? Pocono?
I wouldn't know.
And Nicky and Tommy were there racing their 125s. There was a very bad accident in the practice session and Nicky was involved. A racer called Andre Mattison was killed. As was not any video around, I'm only going for a second.
You talking about Nicky and Tommy Hayden, obviously.
Sorry, yeah, Nicky and Tommy Hayden. He was only going for second-hand info, but he was told that it was Nicky's bike that hit the rider who was killed. Even if it wasn't, it was a tragic and gruesome accident. And to have that type of incident brought up at a PR event sucks. I think Nicky handled it very well, but why would IMS allow someone with that type of agenda to take part? This wasn't an in-depth interview. It should have been focused on positive aspects of the sport. Because basically, a guy was saying, you know, to Nicky, oh, you know, you had this incident, and what do you think about that then? And yeah, he was, I mean, he was
Nicky handled it very well. But yeah. you don't ask that kind of stuff. And then he does it again with Colin when Colin Edwards was on. You know?
That was about Peter Lenz, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And then,
he a good kid?
What kind of a freaking question is that to ask?
Yeah.
You know? So, no, yeah, we're with you, Mike. It was pretty outrageous. I was very pissed.
It's the guy who asked it. We don't want to get ourselves into any sort of libel or slander kind of situation, but is he a motorcycle press reporter or is he a front page reporter?
He is a motorcycle guy, but he likes to call to cover what he calls the personal side of motorcycle racing. He likes to ask questions like, "What's your favorite ice cream flavor?" and stuff.
Which has such a bearing on someone's performance on the track.
Right.
So unfortunately, turning into a soap opera.
Indeed.
We also had a great email from Chris, a.k.a. the Dirty Hippie.
No last name, unfortunately, but...
No. But he said, you guys have... We've apparently been his window into motorcycle road racing and gave me the motivation to do my first track day on the Hockenheim Ring on my RC51. Cool. He said, what a great experience that was, and I'm now going to try and start racing. Thanks again. Thought, blooming heck, we're changing the world.
and I got to say, the RC51 is still one of the greatest motorcycles that Honda's ever made.
It's one of those iconic ones, isn't it?
Yeah, totally cool.
Definitely. And we heard from History of Rome fan, Gary Shavin.
He said, I went to Japan for a week in July for work, so obviously I think there is no danger. No one has to trust the Japanese to give the correct radiation figures. The International Atomic Energy Agency is monitoring the radiation independently to the Japanese, and they are publishing the same statistics. Check the figures, and you will see that anyone will receive more radiation during the 10 to 12 hour flight to Japan and back than they will get during the 4 to 5 days there. As for Rossi specifically, he doesn't ride for the Japanese anymore, but he does ride on Japanese rubber. Bridgestone should say that whoever does not show up in Japan won't get tires for the remaining races of the season, so they won't be exposed to that radioactive rubber. They have the exclusive rights to supply tires, so they can shut this whole issue up in one press release. I love this email.
Yeah. Yes.
Good cheeky stuff.
Yes, and of course we've had Toby Moody continuing from the interview you did with him into his Twitter feed and everything. That a lot of people are ranting, just saying, look, if you're not going to go, just say, I'm not going, I'm scared.
Right.
Be honest about it. Right. If you are going to go, shut up and go. But let's have a race. I think most probably will go. And Lorenzo was saying this week, look, whatever decision I make, it's got nothing to do with the championship. If, you know, people are saying, well, you've got to go to try and close that gap. You know, if Casey goes and you don't, that's it gone. He said, well, we're talking about my health. And I kind of get that perspective. I think he's absolutely right to say that. But I still think, yeah, you should really be going. We were ticked off. I was ticked off by Stuart Scrivener on Facook after my comment.
What does ticked off mean over on your side of the pond?
Told off.
Oh, no. See, ticked off here means that if you say I was ticked off, it means you were pissed off.
Oh, yeah. No,
and of course, pissed that over there means drunk. So we're really now misunderstanding each other.
Yes. Yes, well, I've mentioned it before. If you want to use our language to continue to lease it, please treat it with some care.
All right, sorry, go on.
Stuart Scrivener corrected me on Facebook for the analogy to MotoGP at Indy I'd made of, I'd said Queen of the South are a minor league football team who play at the National Stadium. It's not Queen of the South, it's Queen's Park. And he said, just for the record, Queen's Park play at Hampden Park, not Queen of the South. Not that any of you care a jot. Well, I do, because I've once again confirmed a lot of people's opinion that I'm an idiot. So I am. But thanks for that, Stuart. And I'll probably, just for the record, Queen's Park play at Hampden Park, not Queen of the South. Not that any of you lot care a jot. Yes, Sassanachs. Yeah.
Wow.
I'm presuming Stuart's Scottish. He might just be a very knowledgeable football fan.
Very nice.
And
Very nice.
On to miscellaneous pre-show bits and news and what's commonly becoming the correction section. In fact, we should have put Stuart's bit in there.
Right.
Section of correction. Okay,
well, it leads into there, right? Last week we were talking about the fact that, you know, where's Hiroshi Aoyama going to go when we're doing our little silly season rundown? And, you know, has there been a season without a Japanese writer? And I think I said that 2009 was that season, but that's wrong, because Yuki Takahashi, but he was replaced mid-season, if you remember, by Gabo Tarmashi. Who came in, and that's what we remember for the rest of the season, because he came in pretty early, I think five rounds in, and they were both riding, and they were sharing bikes because there were only two bikes.
That's it.
And then one day Takahashi was not there anymore. I mean, you know, his results weren't that great, but then Gabo Tamashi's were pretty much dismal for the rest of the season. However, he did bring in some pretty good dough.
Massive sponsorship, yes.
Yeah. After I realized that, I got curious and I started looking back through the years, and it wasn't, we have to go all the way back to 1991, which was the last season without a Japanese writer that was, you know, on contract for the whole season. And that was during that season, we had seven Japanese writers who wildcarded Suzuka, but there were no contracted writers for the season. So
no. So it would be quite, if we don't have a Japanese writer next season, it would be quite a
22 years, yeah.
And we also, of course, heard last weekend that Loris Caparossi has announced his retirement at the end of the season. I mean, apparently there were journos getting quite emotional. Loris himself got quite emotional. And I've put many people, myself included, I think, expressing regret that the last few seasons have seen a real rapid slide for Caparex. He's got 99 podiums. And he joked in his press conference and said, look, I'm asking for the aliens up front to help me out here. Help me get to 100. And you just look at it and think, on the Pramac, you're having a laugh. You know, right. I'm sorry, Loris, but for you to get onto the podium, you basically need a race where 14 riders have gone down.
Right.
Yeah, and it's a shame, because this is a three-time world champion. You know, he's been a staple of the MotoGP paddock for a long, long time. And he's a, you know, he's a real character. He's a lovely fella. And, you know, I think I wish him very well. And hopefully, and there was the bit we popped in from when you were talking to Elena Myers about, well, you could come back and manage her in her Moto2 team. And he's just laughed and said, yeah, it's possible.
I don't know why people are saying it's such a shame. I mean, you know, is it because he faded?
Yeah, no, I think it's a shame that the memory that sticks is the last one.
Well, that's not really. I mean, I don't even. It's funny. I was looking through many years of photographs the other day. I was doing a big cleanup on my photos, and it just struck me that he's been on the Suzuki, for example, since 2008.
Yeah,
you know, and I was like, oh my God. Suzuki. But he was already on the Suzuki in 2008. Yeah. And I was like, wow, but I'm always going to equate him with what happened when he came onto the Ducati, because, you know, he was the guy. He was the guy in 2003 who took the first win, first season that Ducati was back. And I'll forever, you know, think of him in those terms, when he was incredibly competitive, you know, and if it wasn't for that injury he had in 2006, who knows what would have happened, you know. So that nasty crash with Gibernau. And so I say, kind of like, you know, let's get over the, oh, it's a shame he kind of faded out, because, you know, he's older, he has a kid. It would be nice to go up on a high note, but really, who does?
No, exactly.
You know, the guys who stick around, well, okay, Troy Bayliss.
Well, people who leave on a high note are always accused of leaving too early.
Well, I think Troy Bayliss is the one guy who didn't leave too early and left on a high note.
Yes.
You know. But that's so rare. That is so incredibly rare.
Yes.
You know. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Oh, and how long is it since someone mentioned his name?
Troy?
Hmm.
It actually has been a while.
I expected him to be more closely involved with it all, I thought.
Yeah, it's a good point. They were still saying, let's just bring Troy back for Ducati last year, remember?
Yeah, crazy. And Colin announced his 2012 plans, which I think we all pretty much knew by the time he announced it. He's going to race an R1 engine CRT bike in MotoGP with Ford Racing, and they're negotiating to try and use a Tectoire chassis, but that's still under negotiation. But that would not be a bad move, because it would be a transitional move for Colin.
Yeah.
Same chassis, different bike and different engine.
But still Yamaha.
But he will become...
Still in line.
Colin, I suspect, will become the benchmark for CRT rider performance.
Absolutely.
If you're in or around where Colin's results are, that's pretty good. If you're way behind Colin, that's pretty bad. So is that you or the bike? You know, just as when a new satellite rider comes up, if you can get in front of Colin Edwards consistently during your first season, wow. That's quite impressive.
It's a good point.
Yeah. Because he is just maintaining such consistency.
It's true. I mean, he's a little bit off this year, I think. He's having a tough year, but some of it has been completely out of his control. I mean, he had two mechanical issues that cost him positions and one DNF. And, you know, I mean, you remember until last year he hadn't had a race where he didn't finish, in points for some ridiculous length of time, you know, like 3 or 4 years, which is unbelievable.
Hence the pressure this year to ride at Catalunya just a day after he broke his collarbone.
Right.
Indy,
very interesting. I actually really was surprised by this announcement. Indy announced that they are extending the contract through 2014. That I expected another 1 year extension, but I guess it's a pain in the ass to have to do this every year. But what's interesting is that we are pretty sure that we're going to have Austin for 2013 and 2014, which would mean Laguna Seca is extended till 2016.
Yeah.
So that would mean 3 US rounds for 2 years, which would be pretty damn cool for us.
Yeah.
So Moto2, Moto3 is only confirmed for 2012, but I don't see why they wouldn't continue doing that. It would mean that there's been talk about putting at least 2 of the rounds back to back in the US to minimize the cost of traveling here. And we were kind of speculating maybe they would do that with Indy and Laguna next year, which, we don't know what's going to happen. I don't think we're going to see Moto2, Moto3 at Laguna next year, but maybe in 2 years, all three classes will come to all three tracks, which would be,
fantastic.
Really be fantastic. Well, it needs to happen. It needs to happen
be
before
the
Seca gets retired,
In 2013, 2014, if we do have 3 rounds, it'd be interesting to see if attendance numbers suffer at all by the dilution or the saturation or the potential saturation. Because when you think about it, I mean, Texas, California, I don't know much about Indiana, I've got to be honest, but Texas and California, in terms of geographical size and population, are pretty much European country sized.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And when you look at it that way,
and Indiana takes care of the East Coast.
Yeah.
You know,
Indiana, Texas goes to the East Coast, Texas, the Southeast, and California, the West. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if you could chuck one up in Montana or Wyoming or Oregon or somewhere.
I think only about 20 people live out in Montana, so that's not going to work.
Maybe not Montana then, but Portland, Bob would be happy.
Yeah.
You'd actually find that people, I'm not sure, only the most dedicated fans are going to, for a Californian to go to Texas or for someone from, for Bob, say, to go to Laguna.
It's a big trip.
That's a greater
trip.
Journey than me going to Catalunya or Mugello or Brno. So I'm not sure that the numbers will suffer that much.
No, you're driving for 14 hours or you're flying, which is exactly what you'd be doing in Europe.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
No, it's a big country. It's a big country. The I think the bigger thing, that the bigger question mark is the size of the motorcycling community. And I think that what the Indianapolis has going for it is the fact that the people who live there will go see any kind of racing. You know, you put box cars out there, or put motorcycles or F1 cars or NASCAR or anything that races, and people will go see it over there. Whereas, you know, California is very, I mean, you can do millions of motorcycle types of events in California, people will go see it. Texas, I don't know that much about in those terms. So that's going to be very interesting. But I think that because F1 is going to be there the year before, it'll get the track on the map. People will know about it.
Also, Ben Spies and Colin Edwards in the paddock. So,
right. Texans, and I'm sure that Kevin Schwantz will pitch in. So, No, it'll be good. It'll be good. I'm looking forward to having another round for a couple of years at least. Now, going along with this story was a reporter for some indie newspaper wrote a pretty scathing article about Casey Stoner, complaining about Indy, and I'm just gonna say that Indianapolis is a great venue. It's a great organization. It's a really shitty track, and I have to agree with Casey Stoner on that one. I mean, it's a shitty track. It's boring. Yeah. It's too slow, and I've never seen a very exciting race there. Unfortunately,
that's what you guys call a roval, isn't it? It's a roval. Road circuit within an oval.
Yeah. Yep.
Yes. Well, my most keenly anticipated bit of today's show is the next item we're going to get onto, because Jules has made a brave statement. You figured out the deal with the leg dangle.
Yes.
Sir, the floor is yours.
Okay. So I was looking through, again, I was bouncing around some photographs, and I have a lot of these photographs where the rear wheel of the motorcycle is off the ground. Right.
Yeah,
and those kinds of photographs are very popular, because it just shows just the power of the brakes. But what you have to understand is that the camera is taking the photos, about 9 frames per second. You know, some photographers have much faster cameras even than that, and so you're just seeing one frame where the tire is in the air. Sometimes you see on the video feed the tire coming up, but it's really kind of bouncing, right? It's not always just sitting up there in the air. They're not doing a full stoppy on the brakes every time they do that. However, what I realize is that they're braking later and later and later because of the strength of the brakes.
Yeah.
Right. In the last 5 or 6 years, you could see the difference, how much deeper they're braking, how much later they're braking. So they're already starting to lean the bike when they are braking, right?
Yes.
So now imagine that the front tire is the only thing basically the whole center of gravity is moving forward. So and because the bike is leaning into a corner, let's say you're going to be turning left, that rear wheel is still got inertia and it's moving forward. So it's going to want to turn the bike too far in that direction that you're leaning. So if you're leaning to the left side, that wheel is going to want to pass you, and it's going to start to swivel the entire bike around the center of gravity, which is now forward. So the leg dangle is a counterbalance to that. They're putting extra weight there to move the center of gravity so that the rear wheel is no longer going to try to pass you.
Mm.
You see what I mean?
Yes. I understand what you're saying.
I think what's going on is that it was not something that somebody figured out. It's just something that felt right. And if you look at the guys who don't do it, they don't lift their rear wheel this way. They don't skip their rear wheel. They brake not so abruptly. They're smooth breakers like Lorenzo, like Spies. They're smooth breakers. And maybe the motorcycle fits their style better. But Rossi, I mean, I have so many images of Rossi with the rear wheel back in, a couple inches off the ground. Stoner is the photo. I'm gonna put a link to the photo that I'm thinking of specifically. It's ridiculous. Like the bike is going, sideways on the front wheel. The wheel was up in the air. But there's his leg hanging out on the side. And that's what made me kind of think it's a counterbalance. It's a counterbalance to prevent the rear wheel from flying past you. It just helps a little bit.
What I think's interesting is they ask the riders, and they're like, I don't know, I just do it. It seems to help, I don't know.
Right.
And it reminds me of going back to the rarely mentioned these days, Troy Bayliss, and someone said to him, do you put your weight primarily on the inside or the outside peg during a corner? And he said, I don't know. I said, what? He said, well, I don't know. I don't think about it. I just, whatever I do seems to work. And now I'm going to try and forget that you've asked me that. Start thinking about it. I might not do what's natural and I'll crash. So don't ever ask me anything like that again. He said, look, I don't think about it that deeply.
Love it.
Which was good. In other news.
Hey, hang on. So come on. So am I right?
Oh,
come on.
Yeah.
It's good.
Just all looking right. At the time, old chap, we've got races. No, we've got 6 races to cover.
Sorry.
Yeah, you're probably right. But I'm not sure that they'd be aware that's why they do it.
I totally agree. I just think that...
I'm also not convinced it
let's
makes
not tell them.
A discernible... I'm not sure it makes a discernible difference when you do look at those who don't do it and those who do. It's not... I don't think it's as revolutionary as the... hanging off style knee down.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
The American dirt riders brought across and completely baffled the Barry Sheens, who went, how do they do that then? In other news, I got away with it this time. Bradley Smith has announced that next year, 2012, he will continue in the Moto2 Championship. Now, he didn't confirm that that's with Tech Toir, although it does seem the most likely, and I think it would be a good career move to stay where he is. But it does clear the way for possibly Dovi or possibly Eugene Laverty to fill that second Tech Toir seat. Now, I tweeted this and mentioned Marco Melandri, but Rick Allen, who is at Kin-A on Twitter, said, oh, Melandri is signed for Kawasaki World Superbike next year. And we can't find any source for that information, so probably best to say he's rumoured to have signed for Kawasaki World Superbike team next year, which of course will not be run by Paul Bird.
Yeah.
Which almost certainly means Tom Sykes is out of a job, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, especially considering what we'll talk about a little later on.
Absolutely.
But first we're going to do Misano.
Yes.
And we'll start with the most interesting race. I mean, not the most interesting race, but certainly the most talked about race of the weekend.
Yes.
Which is the 125s. Johann Zarco on pole.
And he has really having a very good season.
Yes. On a derby.
Yes. Which is an Aprilia. It's just got a different name from the tank. But yeah.
Come on. You've been dying to talk about this. Let's go.
Well, yes. Well, we were doing the setup, weren't we? That Zarco, Fab, Alterol were on the front row qualifying. Vinales was way back. I think he started 10th or 12th or something. And in the championship, of course, it's those three really who were the challengers to Tirol, or Zarco and Vinales.
Right.
So the race started, and Tirol and Zarco. Sorry?
The race started with a bang or two.
Yes. Well, in fact, actually, I missed the first 4 or 5 laps because we were just coming back from a job.
Oh. Well, it started with a bang for real, as in Zarco plowed into Fabel twice on the first lap. Once at the start, where I think both of them were kind of at fault, and again, I think he was retaliating or something. I was ready for him to get black flagged or something. Because it really looked a little bit out of control.
Well, no, I completely missed that bit.
Yeah, that's which makes the what happens later on even more mind-boggling.
We had a group of battling at the front riders. We included Cortese, Fabel, Danny Kent. Vinales at the back of that group.
And man, Danny Kent is really making the best of that ride.
Oh yeah, and he just.
He's really doing bad. I mean, especially...
Fulton's not doing bad because he's been given Danny Kent's dog bike and he's not that far behind.
That's true.
He's closer than Danny Kent was on that bike, but yeah, no, he really is doing well. But Tyrol and Zarco started to pull away at the front. And for long lap after lap after lap, Tyrol was leading, Zarco absolutely glued to his rear wheel. Then he went past. Now, there was interesting. I was watching this on BBC and on the red button on their digital service, and you get the Nick Harris and Gavin Emmett MotoGP feed commentary. Gavin was saying he let him past, and Nick Harris was saying, oh, I think he ran wide.
Yeah.
When Zarco let Tyrol repass him. And it was almost like saying, look, I can have you. And he tucked back in behind. Then on the, was it the last lap or the penultimate lap, Zarco passed him again with a very brave but clean, you know, I'm going round the outside, you will not push me off. That were almost touching.
Was this turn 12, like just past the fastest corner in Misano? I think it was.
Yes,
there,
I
right?
think it was on one of the, yeah, the brave corners.
Yeah.
So Zarco led by into the last corner by 4 or 5 bike lengths. And I'm sure everyone's seen it, but in case you haven't, he then lifts the bike up out of the corner, sits up, looks over his shoulder.
And takes his hand off the left handlebar. Just,
yeah, as if he's trying to reach across and push Tyrol away. And it appeared to me that he looked back and gestured in a taunting manner. That was my first instinct. Then they crossed the line, and we can all see that Tyrol's beaten him because he's done what a proper, serious, clever road cycle racer does, gets his fucking head down and goes for the line. And he won by 0.022 of a second, 22 hundredths of a second. It's just unbelievable what he thought he was doing. Now, as he crossed the line, he was pumping the air and with his fist, which lots of the
Zarco.
Very experienced Zarco was. Lots of very experienced commentators have said, "Oh no, that was anger and frustration because he'd lost another race."
That's what I saw. I saw because he was
pounding
down. He's pounding the fist down like ah. That's what it looked like to me anyway. But he's French, so who knows?
It looked to me like that was yes, I finally won. I think he thought he'd won. I'm convinced
really?
He thought yes.
Cool.
And I'm going to blatantly steal this one. Duncan Bishop, who is a journalist, Spanish-based British journalist for Eurosport magazine, on both motorcycle racing and football, came up with what I think is a piece of brilliant journalism. He said, Zarcolepsy, noun. The act of spontaneously losing concentration and throwing away an almost certain 125cc victory.
I love it.
So we've got Zarcolepsy, Zarcogate. Gonks called him a Muppet. I called him a blithering idiot. And we all agree we'd have loved to have been in his pit box afterwards just to listen to the precise words used by his boss. Excuse me, I'm just going to have to move my mic, which is slowly migrating downwards. There we go. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I have no idea what he's doing. And then afterwards he said, no, I sat up to see where he was going because I knew he was faster than me. I thought, no, shut up.
Right.
Shut up. You should have just said, I'm an idiot, and walked away from the camera. There is no other excuse. That is ludicrous.
And there was just an unbelievable storm on Twitter between some very well-known journalists who really, really wanted to make, really had differing opinions, and were. I mean, Dennis Noyes went through the race very carefully in those last few laps, and he was getting frustrated by the 140 character limit in Twitter, and so he made like 10 Twitters per answer. Toby Moody was calling Zarco basically a blithering idiot, I think. And what I liked actually the most there was what Eugene Laverty said, which is I think goes along with what you were just saying, which is that he said Zarco thought he had in the bag was being cocky. I don't think he's telling the truth as he's embarrassed.
Mm.
You know?
So what it reminded me of was And if he'd had the chance, I'm sure he'd have taken it. Julian Simon in 09 in the 125 race at Catalunya, and he thought he'd won because he was looking at the lap counter on the big tower at the end of the straight rather than his pit board. Do you remember that? And he was celebrating. And then he realised when four riders went past him, heads down, obviously continuing, and he went, doop. Now, he could have come third in that race, I'm convinced, and I'm also convinced he deliberately slipped back to fourth, knowing he still had a big championship lead. It wasn't going to make any difference, and he wouldn't have to do a podium interview.
Right.
If he's, yes, unbelievable. And, of course, the result that this had was instead of reducing Tyrrell's lead to 21 points, Zarco has now allowed it to go out to 31. And whatever people say about whether he thought he had the bag or was cocky, there is no excuse for not
trying
getting to that.
Just not trying. Basically, he, you know, whatever, you know, whether he thought that Tyrrell was going to beat him or not, you still try. And that was, I think, the point that a lot of the people were saying when they couldn't understand why he did that is, and that was me too. I was sitting there like, what happened? Like, I thought maybe he had a failure on the bike. That was my first thought.
Something's blown.
Something's gone, you know? But yeah, you just don't do it. I mean, like, you'll find out in you know, half a second more whether you want or not.
Yeah, anyway, no, absolutely.
It was crazy. It was really weird. There was another interesting theory, which was that he's so inexperienced that he really wasn't sure where Tyrrell was, and he wanted to do some kind of a block pass or something.
Or maybe where the line was. Maybe he thought the line was even, because it's not that far down that straight.
It's not. You come around the corner and then, you know, it's you're still, well, on the faster bikes, you're still leaned when you're crossing the finish line.
Yeah.
Not on the 125s, but. Yeah, so Zarco, I think, blew it. I mean, Dennis Noyes was making very interesting scientific kind of commentary about, you know, drag, coefficient of drag, and how much it would have really slowed down if he brought his head out from behind the bubble, and that he probably still would have lost if he had been all the way down. But that's not the point. The point is he should have been head down in the tank going for the win.
Yeah, the thing is, it's not just the fact that by sitting up, he's making himself less aerodynamic, which is more important on 125 than any of the other classes because they have more power. But also the fact that he wasn't taking the most efficient line. He was drifting around because he wasn't looking where he was bloody well going.
Right.
The guy's an idiot. He may prove one day to grow out of his idiocy, but at the moment, he should be sat in the corner with a cone-shaped hat with a big dick on it and being told, you'll stay there and think about what you've done.
What happened to that guy who used to draw those cartoons over on your side of the pond? What's his name? He's very famous. He does these caricature for a bunch of magazines that cover motorsports. He does both F1 and MotoGP. You should send him that. I forget his name. It's like,
yes,
you know who I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but I can't think of his. I don't know if he's still working.
Yeah.
You don't see them much anymore.
No.
No. Any cartoonists out there, get in touch. Do one of Zarco sat in the corner.
With a dunce hat.
With a dunce hat on, yes.
Like it.
So we've got Tyrrell on 216 points. Zarco's now 31 behind. Vinales is 55 behind Tyrrell. With Cortese only 1 point behind Vinales, who finished in the seventh in that race. So not a great one for... But he did manage to pip Gadea. Just so he stayed ahead of his teammate,
right?
Which must be annoying if you're his teammate.
He was fourth, so you know, some more points. He's getting closer and closer, taking that third away, which would be a shame because Vinales has been the revelation of the season, really. So has Zarco been, but Vinales has been a revelation. That's because he's had good results, but because he's been racing years beyond his actual years in terms of maturity, which is not what we're going to say about Zarco.
I'm shocked when I saw him at Silverstone, just thought, oh my God, he genuinely does look like a 12-year-old schoolboy. Mind you, so does Bradley Smith, but then Bradley Smith will still look like a 12-year-old schoolboy when he's 40.
Right, yeah, exactly. You know,
he's just one of them youthful-looking chaps. So on to Moto2.
Which is also fascinating.
Yes, and Stefan Bradl sort of after his awful qualifying end, he came back and got pole position from Marquez and Yuki Takahashi.
Right, right. And he actually, Stefan was good all weekend. Looked very, very strong. Looked like
Yeah, and as you pointed out, Marquez wasn't looking that great. He was his qualifying lap was pretty much a one-off. Scott Redding, Alex de Angelis and Bradley Smith on row two with Crazy Joe, Ian Oni, Michelle Pirot and Paul Espargaro on row three. And it was a really, really entertaining race. Scott Redding got out front early and led for the early stages, but never got rid of a pack of Marquez, Bradley, Iannone, Smith, De Angelis in close attendance. Yuki Takahashi was pretty close to that lot as well. And then Iannone, Bradley, Marquez. I think Scott, in one lap, went from first to fourth.
Yes.
He got a right kicking. Sat up by, the second-placed rider, and then third and fourth go by as he's trying to get back on the line.
But all credit to him, it didn't really make him lose concentration because he was fighting the entire race. It wasn't like he suddenly...
And basically, him and Bradley Smith settled down to a race-long punch-up for fifth and sixth positions after the leading pack of four, Marquez, Bradley, and Oni, and then De Angelis, who came through about sort of mid-race, I think he came up and joined that lead group. Mm-hmm. Yuki Takahashi was seventh in the end, but up front, Marquez was, it was strange. At first, he looked, a couple of the commentary guys were saying, he seems to be a little bit ragged for him. He's like he was really having to push to stay up with them. And then he seemed to settle down and he took the lead. And you had Iannone in second place for a long period. And then Bradl, you just couldn't get rid of him. They couldn't shake him off.
No, they couldn't. But there was, you think about those four riders, Marquez, Bradl, Iannone, and De Angelis, and how many times they changed positions. There was, I think De Angelis never hit the front, but Marquez, Bradl, and Iannone had been up front. And when Bradl was up front for a while, it looked like he was actually going to start gapping them for a little bit, and then that gap got shrunk again. So,
and I should really sit down and look at lap times, but I was at the time thinking I will have to look at the lap times, which I've since forgotten to do, to see that was Bradl thinking, right, I just can't maintain this because I'm going to crash or destroy my tires, and easing off a fraction, thinking, okay, I haven't completely broken away, or whether it was Marquez and Iannone stepping up to Bradl's pace, thinking, well, if we're going to stay with him, we're going to have to push a bit harder.
Yeah.
But at the end, it was Marquez by 0.6 of a second from Stefan Bradl, who was 0.7 behind Marquez was Andrea Iannone. So only 0.1 splitting those two guys. And I'm sure Marquez would be wishing that Crazy Joe had just managed to hold on to second.
Yeah.
So he has closed the gap to Bradl by 5 points, but it could have been 9. But it's 23 points now. And, of course, Marquez has now won 7 to Bradl's 5. And the point made by one of the commentators was if Marquez continues to win races, which is a big ask to win every one to the end of the season, but he has won 5 of the last 6, doesn't matter what Bradl does, he's going to lose. Marquez will be champion if he wins the remaining races. Even if Bradl's second in every one, it's not enough points.
Right.
He'll lose by 2. So this could be really interesting.
I hope we're going to Valencia with this one. I really do.
Yes.
Because, Moto2 generates good races in Valencia. It's not like a MotoGP event. I think it could be an incredible finish to the season.
And, of course, it's Marquez will be at home. I think he's actually a Catalan lad, but that's not the point. It's still Spain. He's going to have massive support. Bradl will get quite a bit of support from Madrid, possibly, with the large German populations who live there. I don't know. But, it would be nice to see it go down to the wire.
If it goes down to the wire, there's going to be Germans coming from Germany to see it, too. So it's going to be awesome.
There as well. My God. Yeah, I think, mathematically, could Iannone still catch 5 races left? Yes, he could. But he's 101 points behind Bradl, so realistically, no.
Yeah.
It's a two-horse race, but let's hope it stays that way. And then on to MotoGP.
Yes, MotoGP.
Casey Stoner was on pole. And the Yamaha, the little blue and white fly in the HRC ointment was Jorge Lorenzo, 0.12 behind.
Now then Danny, to be fair, Lorenzo looked pretty good entire weekend. It wasn't until qualifying where the Casey Stoner started to really, really show some strength.
Well, I'd expected this to be, before we went into the weekend, I thought it would be Pedrosa.
Yes.
Would be the one to watch. Yeah. Counterintuitively, I tipped Stoner. No, sorry, I tipped Lorenzo to win. But the weekend started with it looking like it was going to be the Danny and Jorge show, and then Casey just did what he does, went out, did a few laps. But interestingly, at the end of QP, you know when they do the analysis of, let's look at who did what laps in which sessions, Casey only got into the 133s on the soft qualifying tyre.
Yeah, exactly. Jorge
had been hitting them lap after lap after lap after lap in the early stages, which I thought was promising for the race, as it proved to be.
Yeah.
Second row, so we had Casey, Jorge and Danny Pedrosa on the first row, Ben Spies, Marco Simoncelli and Andrea Dovizioso, row two, Colin Edwards, Alvaro Bautista, Hector Barbera was row three, and Valentino was middle of row four. So the got away with the race, or the race got away. Brilliant start by Rossi.
Incredible start by Rossi. He was in fourth, the first corner.
Fourth or fifth?
Fourth or fifth, maybe, yeah.
He was fourth. Yeah. He was fourth, you're right. Yeah. I should have the lap chart up. But, yeah, really impressive. And the mistake I made on my tipping, which had Lorenzo to win, Pedrosa to get a place, which all came true, I'd put Blooming Loris to be the first DNF, and Nicky went and continued his incredibly bad run of luck.
He did finish the first lap. So he finally has lapped Misano during a race.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. So it's getting better. Maybe next year he'll do three.
and then Loris basically came in to see if they could sort something out with his bike.
What happened to Nicky? He lost the front end? I don't even know what happened.
Turn 15. Oh. I think it was just a front end wash away. But we never saw the bike go down. The shot that I got on BBC and later on Eurosport was looking at the bikes in front, and you just see the bike sliding with Nicky sliding beside it.
Right.
And then it went away, yeah. Yeah, not a happy place for Nicky. But at the front, Jorge had got himself, after a little bit of dusting up with the HRCs, got himself out front, where he stayed.
Yeah, he stayed. Casey was with him for quite a while, but then started to lose touch, and Jorge just was relentless. His laps were relentless. He was, but this is what he does, right? He just clicks them off. When he gets in that rhythm is just, it's unbreakable. He's one of those riders, actually, that can keep that up even when he's under pressure from another rider,
I think that's the key. We know that Danny can get out and put down lap after lap after lap, of ridiculous perfection. And if you can't stay at that pace, he's gone. If you can stay with him a bit, you can mess him up.
Yeah.
Casey, I think, is improving. He's getting closer to Lorenzo in that ability to maintain when under pressure could, but in 08 in Laguna we saw Rossi do exactly the right thing and mess up his ability to get away,
right.
But I like, that's what I think right from the outset of his MotoGP career, Lorenzo's been able to mix it up, he has this thing, doesn't he, the hammer and the butter, and that was just, that was a well-buttered hammer, I think. I don't know.
I liked it.
But what I really did like to see, and I've not got pelters from listeners, which I was quite expecting, as a Marco Simoncelli basher, But I think this race, this was the one, even though it didn't culminate in a podium, where Simoncelli came of age. And I thought, that's what we expected from him.
And thank God for Simoncelli, because he made this race memorable.
Oh, he was absolutely brilliant. And any doubt anyone had that he was some kind of, you know, well, I can't do anything bad to Rossi because he's my mate. Woof. Sat him up in a corner. Clean move, but he sat him up in the corner and was, I am coming through. Hello. Didn't you used to be a motorcycle racer? It was. I mean, there was no respect there at all. It was, I'm coming through. But it was a good pass. But then he got in a dust-up with Dovi and Ben Spies, all of whom passed Valentino. Now, that was something I found quite revealing or quite surprising, is when Valentino makes up a place, it's very, very rare that we've ever seen him give it back again. Well, he gave three away. Right. He was taken by Simoncelli, Dovi, and Ben Spies.
Well, but that's because I think his start was unusual. His start was unusually good. Usually he ends up in that sixth or seventh spot where he stays. You know, whereas this time he got ahead of those guys and they just had a better pace.
Yeah. But I mean, the dust ups with Dovi and Ben at one stage looked like he was going to take them both, but then was a bit unlucky and got sat up and ended up dropping off a little bit. But those two, oh man, I mean, it was, what's 90 minus 53, 37 thousandths of a second between them at the line, Simoncelli pipping him. But there was a great move in the early in one of the laps where Dovi got the inside on the left-hander and Simoncelli just sat on the outside going, no, I'm not dropping it. No, I'm going to hold it because I know the next corner is a right-hand and then I'm on the inside. Gutsy move. Yeah. I mean, it was just like, that's what we signed up for. That's what we thought we were going to get from you know, Mad Marco. Aggressive but controlled. He didn't look at any stage, he didn't look wild, he didn't look, and he said afterwards, he said, yeah, that's probably my best race.
Yeah, he said it was better than that last beating Dovi there, the way he did was better than a podium for him.
And it's the first time he's come ahead of Dovizioso in a race all season.
Yeah.
So
that has nothing to do with it. I did want to mention one other pass, which was Pedrosa's pass on Stoner in T11.
Yes.
Balls.
Yes.
Massive balls. Foot off the peg when he went into that corner. He committed. I don't think he had it planned. I think he realized that Casey was a lot slower than he expected. But I mean, still mad fast. But a little more passable. I think he was planning to overtake him at the next corner. But the opportunity presented himself, and you could see that he kind of jumped. He literally jumped on it, and it was a little bit unbalanced. But man, T11, right? It's the fastest corner in I think MotoGP, isn't it? It's got to be up there. It's got to be up there. I mean, it's freaking crazy.
It definitely might. Yes.
Yeah. So it was great.
Absolutely.
It was a great pass.
I mean, Danny ran a great race. Now, I mean, I've just been looking at the championship standings, and I think Danny is very, very keen to take third place from Dovi.
Oh, yeah.
But he's 35 points behind. Now, if Casey and Jorge keep sharing race wins, the gap between Danny and Dovi is going to be shrunken. You know, Danny, he might struggle to catch him on that.
Oh, yeah.
And we've got Casey on 259 points. Jorge's 35 points behind. Dovi is on 185, so that's 74 points behind Casey, with Danny Pedrosa a further 35 behind him. Then we've got Ben is 2 points ahead of Valentino and Nicky on 105 points. So Rossi on 133. So it really is, I mean, it's a two-horse race again at the top, similar to Moto2. But I think Danny's really, really motivated. He doesn't want Dovi. We know Dovi's going to leave HRC, or he's going to leave Repsol, at least. I don't think Danny wants to give him any opportunity to say, why you got that seat when I finished the Hyatt? Well, obviously, it's because Danny was injured this season. But no, it was a good race. It wasn't an edge-of-seat bit, except when we saw the Simoncelli-Dovizioso-Spies battles. But it was interesting, and it was just fantastic to see MS-58 sort of get it all together and make that getting it all together last the whole race.
Right, exactly. It's the last.
And it's worth mentioning, if anyone wants to go to the Facebook page and look at the Facebook album Bike Porn, I've added Bautista's Chrome GSVR. Ha! Isn't nice.
It is nice. It is nice.
Toby Moody was saying it looks far, far better in the flesh than it does on television, where it just looks white. But
well, in the photographs, they've done a good job capturing it. It's a little harder to do when you're on the open skies, though. But when you're in the garage, you can see it's, you know, it's pretty wicked looking.
Right, we've got 12 minutes to do two World Superbike races and the World Super Sport one.
Let's go.
There's a challenge for us.
All right, Max Biaggi. So we're in the Nürburgring. We were really looking forward to this one, you and I. Remember we were talking about this?
A massive, massive gap. They had four or five weeks without a race.
Yeah, yeah. And they come back. Oh. Max had something hit his foot. It was during pre-practice on Saturday. No, on Friday already. Because on Saturday he was already suffering during qualifying. But it wasn't the ankle that got broken, but he had a break in the foot itself. So James Whitten was saying that this doesn't really affect shifting because that's the ankle, but it does affect the weighing of the pegs. And so for qualifying, he was able to keep going because the swelling wasn't that bad yet. But by race day, it had gotten really terrible. He had to wear like a boot that was three sizes bigger than his right foot. On his left foot, and we didn't know until the grid formed up. Like,
that's right. Eugene got pipped in the Super Pole, and he said, "Yeah, P2's good, but I want that bloody watch." He's got enough of them. I think he was pipped by Carlos Checa.
Right. It was Checa, Laverty, Biaggi, Melandri on the front row.
Right.
Right.
But Biaggi didn't form up,
and Haga was fifth. But anyway, but by Sunday, so we still didn't know. But I think he even was warming up the bike, and they were going to go out on the grid, and then there was a shot of him, and he was in his skivvies.
Yeah,
you know, he was civilian, so he wasn't going to race. First race, you know, it wasn't very exciting. They kind of split up. Melandri and Laverty had a decent battle. For a little bit, and you know, they stuck together for the entire weekend, actually. But it was a good race, but nothing really memorable happened. I do really love a tricky corner like turn one at Nürburgring, because it really takes a thinking man to do consistent laps there. One guy who we knew would do well here, who was really struggling, was Johnny Ray. How many times did he blow that corner? And even in that race, in a dry race, I mean, it was like three or four times that he completely blew it.
It's just a really strange one. But what was interesting was some of the guys were taking really wide lines, but weren't noticeably any slower than the guys
Laverty.
Taking them up the tighter line.
Yeah. Laverty, for example. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like they sweep wide, but then get so much drive out of that they come back. They're still in front. So,
well, I think that's when it's planned, right? That's why I was saying like the thinking guy who planned the line, whereas I think Ray was finding himself too deep and going, "Oh shit," right?
Yeah.
You know, I got to turn this thing. Damn, I still have to turn.
But you know, I mean, he's been out for 3 months.
Oh, exactly, exactly.
10th place, and I think Johnny Ray was saying, yeah, that'll do. Yeah. But Carlos Checa won comfortably from Marco Melandri, from Norrie Haga on the podium. Yep. Eugene getting pipped again. Mm-hmm. Leon Haslam, Sylvain Guintoli, Juan Lescours, Leon Camier, Ayrton Badovini, Johnny Ray were the top 10, with Tom Sykes, Mark Aitchison, James Toews, and Robbie Rolfo and Troy Corsa rounding out the points. Then we had the World Supersport race. But should we do World Superbike race 2?
Let's finish Superbikes.
Now, I didn't see this at the time because we'd already gone out on another job. I managed to get all the MotoGP bits in, but but I have seen it since, and this race started and ran in torrential rain.
Well, so before we go with the start, I mean, I think that once it started raining and they were on the grid, and then there was a 10-minute delay because it started to rain, and they were, and was allowed to change to wets and all that. I was thinking, well, this is a good chance for Max Biaggi to come and race, because it's going to be probably not as violent of a race for his foot. Maybe he can take it, right? But yeah. If you don't start race one, you don't get to start race two.
Now, that I didn't know.
Yeah. So
I suppose, yeah, because otherwise you're buying yourself more everything time set up.
Yeah. So they actually changed the grid where Haga got promoted to the front row as a result of Max Biaggi opening up a spot, and Melandri and Laverty were next to each other. So, yeah. So I don't know if actually Biaggi even considered it, but yeah, he wasn't going to be allowed to race anyway. So, yeah, it started to come down pretty bad, and the race got off, and you felt bad for anybody who was behind the leader because they were getting spray in the face.
And couldn't see.
It was amazing. There was a couple of times where there were shots from the onboard cameras where it was just like, how the hell do these guys know where the hell they are?
And it wasn't long before you start getting riders coming past the pit lanes, making gestures, quite clearly saying, oi, stop.
Yeah, please, please.
This is ridiculous. You saw Eugene and Marco Melandri tottering around the final corner, both coming down the straight, gesticulating with a cutthroat thing, stop, stop, stop. You know, this is just ridiculous. But, of course, carrying on.
And the puddle that was collecting at the bottom of turn one was getting scary, because you were getting into hydroplane kind of conditions. I mean, you could see that, you know, anybody who took that corner too tight was going, you know, was basically in an inch of water. Well, not about an inch of water, but you know, maybe half an inch of water.
Yeah.
And one of those guys was Haga. Haga was out front, obviously. We forgot to mention the fact that Haga was in a totally different... He was lapping 1 to 2 seconds faster than anybody else on the track. So he was just pulling a massive, massive lead up front. Was it Kamir and Sykes that were in the battle for second? No, it was Guintoli. No. Guintoli was up there.
That's right. We had at one stage they shouted that Johnny Ray had crashed.
Right, but that was not Johnny Ray.
Leon Kamir.
Yeah. That was an evil crash. Evil crash.
Yes, that was horrible.
But it was one of those crashes that where they're just thinking about starting to turn in and they crash. They haven't even, the bike hasn't even actually started to lean, and they just boom. And because they were going so fast on the straight, there was no more braking, and the road was so slick, the bike and the rider both went into the air fence at the very, very far end of turn one. So
I was quite surprised. He actually just got up and walked away, not looking probably a bit shaken. But James Toseland went down and was, now I've not been able to find out if any news on this, but he was walking away holding his wrist again.
Oh, shit.
And thinking, oh, no.
Right.
In the Gravel did a blog. That's the Twitter address, at In the Gravel. Did a blog about James Toseland, where he is with his career, and which was quite interesting. But hopefully that he hasn't re-injured the wrist. But we lost Fabrizio Toseland, Aitchison, Kamir, Tomada, and from the lead, Norrie went
one
down.
And a half laps from the end. Because this delivery...
But of course, it wasn't from the end of the scheduled race.
Right.
It was from they, and I think, I don't know if Jack and James, predicted this, but they were waiting, the organisers were waiting until they'd completed enough laps that they could call it a race.
And not have to do a sprint or half points or anything like that.
Yeah, or wait around for the rain to stop.
Right.
Now, Johnny Ray did crash, but he remounted and finished fourth. But Tom Sykes got his first win of the season. Well, first win in World Superbikes. Sylvain Guintoli was second. Jakob Smerts was third. Then it was Ray, Laverty, Melandri, Badovini, Checker. Carlos Checker came around going, hey, I've got a 76-point lead at the start of that race. I'm not risking anything.
Yeah.
Leon Hazen was 9th, Michelle Berger was 10th, Lascours, Corsa, Rolfo were the only... So 13th place was the last finisher. And it was nonsense. Massive amounts of criticism from the riders after, saying that you know, you're risking our lives there.
Yeah, yeah. And I have to say that I started off saying, let them finish the race, the two-thirds distance, because it's going to get worse. So the sprint race makes no sense. And if they go to half points, then these guys who have been out there for two-thirds minus one or minus two laps, you know, did all that work for half points. So I kind of supported, I kind of can see, when you get that close to the two-thirds distance, I can kind of see why race direction would just say, just keep going, because we don't want to have a sprint race in these conditions. And and they're close enough that they deserve the full points. But now that I've had some time to think about it, I think that you should never risk the safety of the riders, you know?
No.
And they were definitely at risk, because they just started, those last two laps, they just started falling like flies. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Hard crashes.
But it just didn't stop heavy rain. However, in between those two races, we had a very bizarrely dry World Supersport race where Chas Davies made an awful start and was down in 9th or something. James Ellison running very well. Sam Lowe's Gino Rea got a rocket start out the front. We also had Fabian Ferre up there and Lucas Gasser. And then Chas just majestically made his way through. And the Welsh boy done good, and he won. But only by 91 thousandths of a second from James Ellison. Gino Rea had crashed out, which he found really baffling. But Sam Lowes was third, making it an all-Brit podium on the World Supersport. And Chas, with three races left, because, of course, World Supersport only run one per meet, is 75 points... there's 75 points left, and Chas is 59 points clear of David Salom, who's not really doing as well as he was early doors. So, you don't want to be too presumptive, but I think Chas is definitely, he's probably of all the world level championships, he's the one who's most secure.
Yes, exactly. I was just going to say that we've gone through six different, five different series, and his is looking the best now. I did want to point out how James Ellison is now 8th in the championship and tied for points with Gino Rea. And, you know, he's kind of coming back. So,
yeah.
Because he said he was a horrible, you know, first half of the season. And to see him this high up is actually quite surprising.
Yeah, I know. And I think
not surprising because I don't think he's a great writer. I think he's a great writer. I think he's been struggling with the
But he's been in superbikes, in British superbikes for several seasons. So to, you know, it was the transfer down in the 600s, it was circuits he's not seen for quite a few years. Yeah. Some completely new. So it's good to see. It's always nice to see someone rejuvenated. So looking forward, we've got BSB Donington Park, the first round of the showdown, as they're calling it this weekend. I'm hoping Michael Rutter comes back and races, because I've got him in my fantasy road race team.
Same with me.
Because Hopper was injured. So
you're taking a beating now, aren't you? In that.
Yeah, I'm plummeting.
Yeah.
So we've got Donington Park this weekend. Following weekend, we've got Aragon, where Jules is going
to
be.
Yes, I'm leaving on Monday to go to Spain, and I'm going to be at Aragon. So, you know, meet up at motopodcast.com if anybody wants to meet up. I know I'm going to meet up with Len Padilla, who used to fans MotoGP on Twitter. You know, if anybody else wants to hook up, just that's the email address.
Brilliant. And yeah, and of course we've got after that we've got Monza and Silverstone in World Superbike and BSB, and the weekend after that, first weekend of October. Oh, 3 days before I fly to Cyprus for a week's holiday, we will have the Motegi race, if we have the Motegi race.
Right,
dude. I've got to go and get ready for work.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Martin, for making time this morning, and take care.
No problem at all. Cheers, all.
Yeah.
Bye. We'll